Several years ago, I had an opportunity to work for a radio ministry. And part of my job there at the ministry as a pastor on staff was every once in a while they would open up the phone lines and they'd invite people to call in and share some of their struggles or whatever they wanted prayer for. It could have been a variety of things. And so it was a joyful privilege of mine to be able to hear people sharing their sorrows. Some of the situations or some of the types of calls we would receive are this. You know, there was a couple in New York who had an adult daughter who had been killed by the handgun of an assailant. She'd been murdered. And it had been 2 years before that the incident had happened, and they were still bearing this grief. They said they just walked in a fog of grief, and they hadn't been able to even go in their daughter's room and put their things away. Another gentleman called about telling me the story about his wife who'd left him with two children to raise, and he just sunk into a deep despair. And then he met another woman, and his friend said, "You've never been happy in your life." And so they got married, and about 3 weeks after the wedding, tragically, the new bride had a fatal aneurysm and died suddenly. And the man said, "I still have wedding presents we haven't unwrapped." Another woman called and said her husband is an angry man. After a recent tirade, he left for the weekend. She said, "Our house is in peace for the first time, and I can't remember when, and I know he's coming home, and I don't know what to do." Another woman said that her self-condemning thoughts race through her mind, and she has a nagging fear that God has cast her out. She struggles with depression. On and on the stories went of affairs, abuse, molestation, wayward children, addictions, financial problems, legal struggles, death, hopelessness, despair. And I had the joyful privilege of listening to people in the depths of suffering tell me their problems. Now you may say, "Bryce, you're kind of weird. Listening to suffering people all day sounds sad and depressing." And I would say, you're right. I am weird. And listening to people all day talk about their suffering is sad and depressing on one level. On one level. But as we're going to discover today in the Psalm 130, on another level, it's possible, listen to me, in the midst of an absolutely terrible circumstance, to experience something absolutely extraordinary. In the depths of our deepest suffering, it is possible to find God. And with Him, joy. Turn to Psalm 130 with me, if you will. Psalm 130. The author is David, perhaps. A song of ascents. Now, this psalm is interesting because it's 8 verses divided into 4 parts, 2 verses each part. The first part is the cry for mercy, verses 1 and 2. The second part is the focus is on God's compassionate character, the compassionate character of God. The third part is our course of action. And the fourth part is our call to trust. So did you get that? The first part is a cry for mercy, the compassionate character of God, the course of action, and the call to trust. Let's read verses 1 and 2. "Out of the depths," the psalmist cries, "I says, I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to my cry for mercy." The first 2 verses of the psalm lead us into this deep pit of suffering. It's dark in there, agonizing, terrifying, lonely. This place is as far from joy as you can get. If joy was strolling along a white sand beach in Florida, in a tropical paradise, with someone you love, the experience that the psalmist describes here is sinking in quicksand. In a bug-infested, stinky, sweltering swamp. I think they have those in Florida too, don't they? In a remote Florida jungle, all alone. If joy is floating in a hot air balloon with a group of your best friends, this is falling into a cavernous pit with no way out, no light, and no one to help. This is the depths. Out of the depths, I cry to you, O Lord. The depths is Joseph, betrayed by his own brothers, who at first wanted to kill him. Can you imagine your own brothers conspiring to kill you? But then they decided, well, let's just throw him in a pit so we don't have to get our hands messy. And then they said, well, at least we can make some money off of him. So they sold him into slavery. That's the depths. The depths is David stealing another man's wife for a one-night affair, then finding out she's pregnant and arranging for her husband to be killed in battle. And then after the cover-up, realizing the heinousness of his sin and its terrible consequences to his family and the people he loved. David described what it's like in the depths in Psalm 38. Turn back there. Psalm 38, just a few pages over. Read in David's own words what it's like in the depths. He says this. Verse 4, my guilt has overwhelmed me like a burden too heavy to bear. My wounds fester and are loathsome because of my sinful folly. I bowed down and brought very low. All day long I go about mourning. My back is filled with searing pain. There is no health in my body. I'm feeble and utterly crushed. I groan in anguish of heart. That's life in the depths. The depths is Jonah on the ship that's being torn apart by the storm that was judgment for his disobedience, realizing the destructive power of his sin. And then being cast away into the sea. And as he sinks into the sea, he says, deep in the realm of the dead, I called for help. He said, I've been banished from your sight, Lord. The depths is Job clawing at his ulcerated skin in the utter misery and grief, losing his entire family and his health. Here's righteous Job, a man who was doing everything right when all of a sudden everything went wrong in his life. Job is the archetype of suffering. Turn to Job chapter 30. Job chapter 30. An archetype means simply the original pattern or model from which all things of the same kind are copied or on which they are based. When we enter the story of Job, we're entering suffering in its first form. Look in Job 30, verse 16. And now my life ebbs away. Days of suffering grip me. Night pierces my bones. My gnawing pains never rest. Verse 25. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? He's a righteous man. Yet when I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, then came darkness. The churning inside me never stops, he says. Days of suffering confront me. I go about blackened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I've become a brother of jackals. He roams the wilderness, a companion of owls. He has no home to go home to. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My harp is tuned to mourning, my flute to the sound of wailing. Eugene Peterson, in his translation of this verse, says, He says, my fiddle plays nothing but the blues. There's Job playing nothing but the blues. We might say his guitar plays nothing but the blues. It's tuned to wailing. Reminds me of someone who passed recently, B.B. King. The king of the blues, right? B.B. King made a whole career writing hundreds and hundreds of songs about suffering, usually at the hand of some wicked woman that done him wrong. How blue can he get, B.B. King writes. I gave you a brand new Ford, but you said, I want a Cadillac. I bought you a $10 dinner, and you said, thanks for this snack. I let you live in my penthouse, and you said, it's just a shack. I gave you 7 children, and now you're going to give them back. I said, I've been downhearted, baby. Can you hear them? Yeah. Play it, baby. I said, I've been downhearted, baby. Ever since the day we met, our love is nothing but the blues, baby. How blue can you get? We sing songs about it. Suffering is pain plus. writes Eugene Peterson in his book, A Long Obedience. Pain plus, physical or emotional pain plus the awareness that our own worth as people is threatened, that our own value as creatures made in the dignity of God is called into question, that our own destiny as eternal souls is jeopardized. Are we to be finally nothing? Are we to be discarded? Are we to be rejects in the universe and thrown into the garbage dump of humanity because our bodies degenerate, or our emotions malfunction, or our minds become confused, or our families find fault with us, or society avoids us? Any one of these things can put us into what Psalm 130 calls the depths. We cry out of the depths. We cry to the Lord, "Have mercy!" This is prayer at its most raw. Shakespeare spoke of a kind of grief that lies all within. It's inside. A grief that swells with silence in the tortured soul. But there's nothing silent about this grief. It demands to be heard. No soul can contain it. It cries out to God in swells of guttural explosions, followed by wailing sobs. God, have mercy! Have you been to the depths? Have you been there? Maybe you haven't been there, but maybe you know someone who's been there. It's hard to know what to do or say. It's hard to know what to do. You could always call AAA. That's what I do when I'm in a crisis. I call AAA. Not the auto club, but you might think of these as the AAA responses to suffering, only these responses aren't very helpful, really. The first A in AAA is alleviate. Our first response is a natural one. It's a human one. It's a noble one. We try to alleviate the suffering. But this kind of suffering can't be mended. Still, we try with conciliatory words. Things will look up. You'll just wait and see. Don't worry, you'll look back on this in a year and laugh. I'm sure you'll find a way through this. Come on, you've been here before. You can do it. It can't be all that bad. I mean, God will make a way. Sometimes we even say really stupid things. One woman told a mother who lost her toddler son in a drowning accident, "At least you don't have to potty train him." Oh, that makes me feel better. But this is our first response. We want to help the pain go away. We want to alleviate the suffering. The second A is avoid. Being around a suffering person is difficult. Being around suffering is fearful because we might suffer too like that. And so the best thing to do sometimes is to avoid it. We may say, "Well, this reminds me of the time," and just try to get the subject onto something else. Or sometimes guys will say, "You know, let's talk about sports. So how about those Padres, you know?" Sometimes we just walk the other way. One woman who lost her baby was walking down the hallway in church, and a woman with a newborn, she saw them, their eyes kind of met, and the woman with the newborn just walked the other way. She didn't know what to do. It's hard. Alleviate. We try to alleviate. We try to avoid. We even try to advise. The third A. "Well, you should see my doctor. He's done miracles. Have you tried this? I used to feel like you, but what helped me was," fill in the blank. The problem with these responses, as well-intentioned as they may be, we all do them, is that they attempt to shut down the person's experience. They are in the depths, and you can't help them like you really, really want to help them. We think that we're helping someone if we can somehow turn off the reality. Reality can be excruciatingly brutal, and it's hard for us to look at it. We'd rather switch the channel. That's what I do when I'm watching something terrible on TV. I just switch the channel. We'd much rather float glibly down that old ancient river in Egypt, denial, oblivious to the harsh realities of life. Never deny someone's suffering. If they're suffering, they're suffering. Just be with them. Trying to deny it just devalues their experience and disrespects them. Jesus never did that. Remember the story of the woman who had the issue of blood, and for 12 years she had sought out physicians who just caused her to suffer more and more. Years of suffering and humiliation. And in the story, Jesus receives word that an official's daughter was dying, so he heads off to help the daughter. The crowd is crushing around him. They're excited. They're like a pool of, you know, a bunch of fish. They're like a swarm? School. They're like fish all around him, you know, just moving him along, right? And then this woman who's suffering, just she's too embarrassed, she's too ashamed, she just reaches out and touches the hem of his robe. And Jesus stops and he says, "Who touched me? There's somebody suffering here. Who touched me? Who is it? I feel them." And that's Jesus. Who among us is suffering? He knows. Jesus enters into our suffering, and therein lies the power of the gospel. Eugene Peterson says, "The gospel offers a different view of suffering. In suffering, we enter the depths. We are at the heart of things. When we suffer, we enter into the heart of things. We are near to where Christ was on the cross." When we are in the depths, we're near to Christ on the cross than ever before. Welcome to the heart of things if you're suffering today. Welcome to the cross. Out of the depths, I cry for mercy. And what do I receive? I see the character and compassion of an almighty God. Turn back to Psalm 130, verses 3 and 4. The character and compassion of an almighty God. Look at verse 3. "If you, O Lord, kept a record of sins, O Lord, who could stand? But with you there's forgiveness. Therefore, you will be feared." Or in the latest translation of the NIV, what is that word? I wrote it down. The latest, what? With reverence we serve you. I can't read my own writing. We can with reverence serve you. But with you there is forgiveness, and we can with reverence serve you. So here's God being who he is, creator, designer, supreme moral agent, sovereign ruler, holy judge, ultimate source of love, does what only God can do. Namely, he deals with the primary problem. And this is the part of the psalm that our modern minds have a hard time grasping. All this talk about sin seems off point. Hey, what about me? My suffering is the issue here. In our culture, writes Peter Kreeft in Making Sense Out of Suffering, the most important thing in our culture in life is conquering suffering and attaining pleasure, comfort, and power. The most important thing in the kingdom of God, in the kingdom where God lives and rules, the most important thing is not conquering suffering right away, but the most important thing is reconciliation with God. Reconciliation with God, union with God, conformity to God. And so in a song about suffering, the psalmist first thinks about connection with God, because that's what's really most important, especially when we're suffering. He says, "I really need God." Whew. It's a good thing God keeps no record of my sin. Otherwise, I would be suffering and disconnected from God. How horrible that would be. I would have no place to stand, and I would be swept away. If it wasn't for God's compassion and forgiveness, I would have no place to stand. We've been watching in the news recently of the floods in Texas. I have some relatives in Texas, and at their church, there's one family whose house was swept away in the flood when the river swelled and swept the house away. There's some family members they still haven't found. And that would be us, my friends, if it wasn't for God's compassion and forgiveness. The river of suffering, we'd come and we'd be swept away. But we have a place to stand, thank God. We are not just suffering, but we are connected with God in the suffering. God here is the focus of the psalm. It's all about God, not my suffering, it's about God. Eight times his name is mentioned. Look in verse 1. I cry to you, O Lord. Verse 2, O Lord, hear my voice. Verse 3, if you, O Lord, kept a record of sins, O Lord, who could stand? Verse 5, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits. Verse 6, my soul waits for the Lord. Verse 7, put your hope in the Lord, for with the Lord is unfailing love. God is where suffering is. And there you'll find him at work, not to abolish suffering, at least not yet, but to create connection by abolishing sin. God is at work, not yet to abolish suffering, but to abolish sin and the guilt of sin. This baffles people. We have a hard time understanding this in our culture. The fact is that God is deeper than the deepest depth in man. He is holier than our deepest sin is deep. There's no depth so deep to us as when God reveals his holiness in dealing with our sin. And so think more of the depth of God than the depth of your cry. The worst thing that can happen to a man is to have no God to cry out to out of the depth. P.T. Forsyth. God is never more real than in our suffering, because suffering makes us yearn for the realness of God. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are, say it with me, you are with me. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are, yes. And in order to be with God, God must deal with my sin. He must cancel the record of our sin through divine forgiveness. Forgiveness is basically this. You've got a whole screen full of stuff on your computer at home, and you highlight it all, and then what do? You hit the delete button. It's gone. Now, some of you say, well, it's still in the hard drive. It's just you can't see it. Well, here's what God does. He rewrites our hard drive. For to him who knew no sin, he became sin on our behalf, that we might rewrite our hard drive with the righteousness of Christ. Isn't that beautiful? Christ died on the cross for our sin. He took our sin on himself, and he gave us his righteousness. We don't appreciate just how precious the gift of forgiveness is until we're in a place in which we really need to be close to God, like when we're in the depths. There's a great line from a bluegrass song, you never miss the water till the well runs dry. You never miss God till you suffer. And then you look for him, you yearn for him, you want him near. Oh, God. And thank God he's given us a way to be near him. Turn to Hebrews 4. Hebrews 4. This verse may never have looked to you, these verses may never have looked to you like they look right now as we're talking about suffering. Hebrews 4, verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who's gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, who is unable to understand our suffering. But we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are. He's been there, yet was without sin. Let us then, look, what's the result, the connection? Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence. We have a place to stand before God so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need, like right now. Psalm 130. We cry out to God. We experience his compassionate character in forgiving us. And then what's our course of action? Look at verse 5, it says this, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen wait for the morning, more than watchmen wait for the morning. He repeats it. I love that. Now that my connection with God is secure, what do I do? Wait. Well, that doesn't sound like doing a whole lot. Well, what do I wait for? I wait for the morning, the new day. Back in the 60s, we learned a lot about kind of the idea of a new world. While the young people of the 60s, their parents were building rockets to go to the moon and explore new worlds, the young people were dreaming of building a new world right here on Earth. And they did it through kind of a counter-cultural way, you know. They wanted to throw flowers, you know, right in the middle of the Vietnam War, and so the contrast between the flowers and the bullets, you know. They wanted to spread harmony and peace. There were Pepsi songs written about it and Coke songs written about it. Young people were dreaming of, there's a new world coming, Cass Elliot crooned. And it's just around the bend. You remember Mama Cass? The mamas and the papas, California dreaming, takes you back. There's a new world coming. It's just around the bend. There's a new world coming. This one's coming to an end. Mama Cass has been reading her Bible. There's a new voice calling. You can hear it if you try. It's growing stronger with each day that passes by. There's a brand new morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawning that belongs to you and me. Yes, a new world's coming. The one we've had visions of, coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in love. Don't tell me you don't remember that song. I've been singing it all week. There's a new world coming. That's about all I'm going to sing for you. Now, those children of the 60s are in their 60s, and this is the new world they envisioned. Welcome to it. That imagining there no heaven, I guess it didn't work out so well. They wanted the kingdom of God without God, and it just won't work. The Christian should be the ultimate optimist, even in suffering. Why? Because we have a connection with God who will set things right. There's a new world coming. It's true. Eugene Peterson writes this. This is why we can face, acknowledge, accept, and live through suffering. For we know that it can never be ultimate. It can never constitute the bottom line. God is at the foundation and God is at the boundaries. God seeks the hurt, the maimed, the wandering, the lost. God woos the rebellious and confused. If God were different than this, not one of us would have a leg to stand on. Because of forgiveness, we have a place to stand. We stand in confident awe before God, not in terrorized despair. This is how Paul can say, we are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We are persecuted, but not abandoned. We're struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Christ, the cross, the suffering of Jesus is in us, so that the life, the hope, the promise of Jesus may be revealed. Now, back to the waiting part. How can waiting be action? It's certainly not inaction. We can be going about our day, doing what we've always done, fulfilling our responsibilities, taking care of business, all the while inside we're waiting. We might call it active waiting. We're acting, but with a waiting frame of mind, as opposed to a worried, anxious, panicky, preoccupied way of acting. Waiting is an attitude that accompanies our doing. It says, these things over there, I have some control over, so I'll do them. But those things over there, that's God's stuff in his hands. So this is the Bryce zone, and that's the God zone. I'll take care of what's in the Bryce zone, and I'll wait for God to take care of what's in the God zone. There's a good deal of peace in that. I wait. And I hope, verse 5, My soul waits for the Lord, verse 5, and in his word I put my hope. Notice that our hope is in the word, his promise backed by his character. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. God will meet all your needs according to the riches of his glory in Jesus. All these promises are based on a relationship with God in the midst of our suffering. And that relationship with God in the midst of our suffering, that's where the joy is. In spite of the circumstances. See, that's not human. That's not natural. The joy in the midst of bad circumstances can only happen if there really is a God and we're waiting on him. That's the reason we plant flowers in our garden of hope, just on the other side of this wall. We don't plant thistles and thorns, depressing stuff. We plant flowers. We go there to find God and to find hope. And there's beauty in that. Surely there's something I must do to get God to act more so my suffering will end. Pray more, I'll pray like a monk in a monastery. Give more, I'll give all I have. Serve more, I'll work my fingers to the bone. Be a nicer person, I'll be the sweetest person in the world. Be a better person, I'll be a saint. But you see, God isn't looking for religious perfection. He's looking for relational connection. He doesn't want you to do more to earn his blessing that you already have in full in Jesus. He's blessed us in the heavenly realms with every spiritual blessing. Now, as you're living in anticipation of the revealing of all these blessings, be a watchman. A watchman exists in the night but lives for the morning. He's of the world, but he's not interested in the world. A watchman accepts what is because he knows what will be. A watchman accepts what is because he knows what will be. A watchman is patient in the moment but is excited about the future. A watchman grows in anticipation the longer he watches and the nearer his shift comes to an end. Amen? He grows in anticipation the longer he watches and the nearer his shift comes to its end. And the psalmist in verse 7 calls us, in light of all this, to trust. So verse 7, O Israel, put your hope in the Lord. With the Lord is unfailing love, and with him is full redemption. He himself will redeem Israel from all their sins. Unfailing and full. Unfailing love, full redemption. Unfailing love will not bend or break, no matter how strong the forces that push against it. Full redemption is complete, not allowing the smallest sin to remain unforgiven. We rest in the unfailing love of God, and we have redemption. Christ has paid the price for our sin, and he now owns us. And we look forward to the completion of God's redemptive plan when he returns. Let's take a moment and respond to what we've heard by just bowing our heads, closing our eyes, creating a little bit of a sanctuary right there in your pew. This will just take a moment. Right there in the pew, in the quietness of this very moment, I want you to imagine yourself like Jonah, sinking into the depths. Are you in pain? Are you in doubt? Have you done all that you can do and still you're sinking? Have you lost strength? We're sinking into the depths. Cry out to God. In your heart, cry out to God. Don't hold back. Focus on his compassion and his character. Here he comes. Rest in his word. He's there with you. He promised he would be. You may be suffering, but you're not alone. Rest in his word. He is holding you. Stay focused on him. Draw power from those arms of love. Stay close. Some of you this morning walked into this room wondering what tomorrow will bring. And when you walk out of this room, you still won't know what tomorrow will bring. But God is with you. Put your hope in him, not in the circumstances, not in the paychecks, not in the job, not in the career, not in the family, not in anything else. Put your hope in him. As you walk out of this room today, walk with your head high. My hope is in a God of love and compassion. And I will wait for you.